We've got a mess here. He hesitated. I need you too, Osgood, and Julian Farrow, and call the Bristol Police Station for backup. We need CIU, firefighters, cops. We need everything they can send. You escort Miss Devine to Ilya Sanguinati's office, then you hightail it out here.
Yes, sir.
A pale sound, but Osgood would be there. He pulled the cruiser onto the shoulder of the road and ran toward the burning vehicles. But the fire burned too hot for him to get close enough to determine if anyone had survived. He hoped not.
Anyone out there?
He shouted. The crews in the flatbed trucks were gone, but the men who had been felling trees might have seen the funnel in time to run. Sirens. A lot of sirens. Too soon for any help from Bristol, but they would be coming. Captain Hargreaves would see to that. The volunteer firefighters arrived first with the fire truck and a water tanker, followed by the EMTs and Dr. Wallace. Officer Osgood and Julian Farrow brought up the rear. Osgood stumbled out of the passenger side of Julian's car and stared at the fire, making Grimshaw wonder if a potentially good cop had seen too much, too young. Then Osgood shook his head, as if to clear it, and ran to where Grimshaw waited.
Take the cruiser and go down the road,
Grimshaw said.
Block it off. I'll have Julian block off the road at this end.
Yes, sir.
Osgood stared at the fire.
The others are angry.
Grimshaw nodded.
But not with us. Get going.
As soon as Osgood headed for the cruiser, Grimshaw turned to Julian Farrow.
Julian said, This morning, Vicky and I met Fire, who calls himself Aiden. He was riding a horse named Twister.
Gods,
Grimshaw breathed.
How's Vicky?
How do you think? A fire was reported at the jumble. No one could tell her if the buildings were burning or some other part of the property.
I need you to man the barricade at this end of the road. I need to find one of those bridle paths or any kind of trail that will get me around to the other side of the fire. There were men out there cutting down trees. I don't know if they got away.
And you have to check on Dane and the rest of them.
Have to do my job.
Caw!
Grimshaw turned toward the sound and spotted the crow. He figured it had to be one of the crow guard. All the ordinary birds would have fled from the fire.
Baggy? I need to find a trail to the main house.
The crow flew off between a break in the trees. Grimshaw hurried to follow. If the fire cut him off from the road, he'd head for the lake.
Keep reporting in, Julian called.
The game trail opened onto a bridle path. Grimshaw jogged to keep up with Aggie until she landed in a tree and didn't continue. Obviously, she wasn't going to lead him any farther. He pointed at the path in front of him.
The main house is that way?
Caw!
He took a step, then looked at the crow.
If the wind doesn't change direction, more of the jumble will burn. Miss Vicky would be sad about that.
No response, so he followed the path. He didn't know if Aggie had delivered the message that fast, or if something else had been listening. But when he reached the access road a minute later, the wind had shifted, blowing the fire back over already scorched earth. The moment Grimshaw's foot crunched on the gravel, four armed men swung toward the sound.
Hey,
he said, holding up his hands, palms out. Swin and Reynolds looked spooked enough that he felt lucky they hadn't fired out of reflex. The other two men? Yeah, private security for sure. Grimshaw turned to Yorick Dane, who was clumped with his business partners.
Is everyone all right? All the people staying with you?
Dane stared at the charred husks of trees, then raised a shaking hand.
Is that a body?
He moved in that direction for a closer look.
Gods, let those men be removed from all suffering.
He counted four bodies before he walked back to where Dane stood.
What happened? Vaughn demanded.
Fire tornado, Grimshaw replied. It hit the two flatbed trucks and the construction equipment you were bringing in, and then took out the crew felling trees.
He tried to chain the anger swelling inside him.
You were warned.
Even Vaughn looked shocked. Most likely, they'd been getting away with underhanded deals since their university days, if not before. This should have been nothing different. Except they weren't dealing with humans anymore.
We'll have to leave, Darren said. That truck is blocking the way and has to be moved.
He looked at the burned-out truck the loggers had driven and shook his head.
The firefighters are still bringing the fire around the flatbeds under control. You've got thousands of pounds, maybe a few tons of burning, twisted metal blocking the access road.
He pointed to the burned truck.
Nobody will be moving that one for a while.
The men stared at him.
Then how are we getting out?
Dane asked.
You're not, Grimshaw replied. Well, you can pack a light carry-all and walk out, following the bridle trails until you reach the road.
Emerson,
Vaughn said, turning to the beefy blonde man.
We can take my boat and go to the public beach and get help there, Emerson said, or go across the lake to that big lodge I saw on the other side. Does that boat have a motor?
When Emerson nodded, Grimshaw turned to Dane.
Didn't you tell your friends about the no motor rule on this lake? Are you looking for ways to get these people killed?
He turned back to Emerson.
Even if you take out a rowboat, you do not want to go across to Silence Lodge. Not today.
Emerson narrowed his eyes.
Why? Who owns Silence Lodge?
The Sanguinati.
Uneasy now. All the men shifted their feet.
Look, Grimshaw said. The main house and the lakeside cabins are probably the safest place right now. Your cars aren't going anywhere until the road is cleared, and that could take a couple of days.
Or more. The flatbeds had been burning when he'd run to check on the people here, but his impression had been of metal twisted and melted into nightmarish shapes. Not the kind of thing you could roll out of the way.
Vicky should have widened the access road and built a second entrance, Dane said. We wouldn't be in this mess if she'd put enough money into this place.
Grimshaw stared at York Dane. Was the man actually pouting because the ex-wife he was screwing on a business deal hadn't gone into debt to do more improvements? He shook his head, disgusted with all of them.
Hear those sirens? That's the Bristol Police and Fire Department coming in to help. You all do what you want. I'll inform the CIU team that you're all alive, but there are burned bodies that need to be identified. I imagine someone will come in soon to talk to you. It would help if you could provide the names of the loggers you hired to illegally cut down those trees.
Now see here, Vaughn protested. We did nothing illegal.
Grimshaw held up a hand.
I'm not interested. That's for someone else to figure out. Just remember that the someone who is going to decide isn't a member of your damn club.
Ignoring their protests and vitriolic opinions about his parentage, Grimshaw followed the bridle path, then chose a game trail heading in the right direction. A few minutes later, he reached the road. The firefighters had contained the blaze and were hosing down the surrounding grass and trees, and no doubt would continue until the water tank ran dry. They were being thorough because, like sweat and ash, fear was a taste in the air. Chapter 64. Vicky. Thaysday, Sumer 6th. As soon as the Bristol police arrived to assist Grimshaw, Julian drove back to Sproing and picked me up at Ilya Sanguinati's office. We stopped at Pops Davis's general store and bought some food that wouldn't spoil if we didn't eat it for a day or two. Then Julian drove us to the Mill Creek cabins. Beer wasn't my favorite drink, but I didn't say anything when Julian offered me a bottle before settling into the other chair on his porch. I could see the watermill from where I was sitting. It looked quaint, peaceful. I wondered if I would ever feel peaceful again. I feel bad about the men who died, I said. Their boss might belong to that stupid club, but that doesn't mean those men did. They came here to do a job, just like any other job, and they died because York and the rest of those men thought they could take whatever they wanted, like York had done with me. And I keep thinking about all the men I had hired to renovate the main house and the cabins, the men who had brought in the bulldozer and backhoe and all the other equipment to replace the septic system. They could have been killed.
I don't think so, Julian replied. You were very careful about what you were doing. I remember you saying that you had reviewed the terms of the property agreement with all of your contractors to make sure you and they didn't violate the terms. And, Vicky, you hired firms from Crystalton, which meant you had hired Intuits. It stands to reason that at least one of the men on those crews would have known before the first shovel of earth was dug up if they were doing something dangerous. The Terra Indigene wanted the jumble restored, and you were doing that. And who was your first lodger? One of the Crow Guard. A test.
Probably.
I thought she was a girl who had run away from home and needed a safe place to stay. Until the whole eyeball thing. Julian sipped his beer.
I bet you didn't charge her anywhere close to what you could get for a week's stay in one of those renovated cabins.
I shrugged, unwilling to admit he was right. I'd wondered where she kept getting the money for the weekly rent, but she paid promptly and didn't cause trouble. And I didn't hear about any houses in the village being burgled, so I thought she'd tuck some money away before leaving home. Come to think of it, I still didn't know where she got the money for the rent. Thinking about the men who had done the renovations and the big improvements made me wonder about something else. Why didn't the men York hired look at using the farm track and the grassy lane that my contractors had used? Instead of taking another sip, Julian lowered the beer bottle.
What?
The farm track that forms the boundary between the Milford's orchards and the jumble, where Aggie found the dead man. The crews I hired came in that way. The foreman said it was the long way round, but the grassy lane going into the jumble was wide enough for them to reach the meadow where the septic tank was located. I frowned. No, that wouldn't have worked. The lane ends at the septic tank.
That grassy lane that connects to the farm track. Is the turnoff before or beyond where you found the body?
I looked at Julian, who foolishly waited for an answer.
You have no clue, he finally said.
The only time I saw the lane was when the foreman drove me to the meadow to show me the new septic tank before they covered it up. Aggie and I followed a path in the woods to reach the body. I sounded defensive. I felt defensive. I tried. I really did. But the "you are here" map that everyone else seems to have in their head, I didn't get one.
Vicky.
It was a soft warning. I followed the direction of Julian's gaze and saw Aiden walking along the road, accompanied by a chubby brown pony with a storm gray mane and tail. I thought about the men who died today, because the person who had hired them had knowingly broken the rules set down by beings who had no interest in the kinds of petty games humans played with one another. I thought about the men I had hired to do work in the jumble. And most of all, I thought about the friends whose actions might be misunderstood. I would never be able to rebuild my life again if a friend died because of me. I set the beer bottle on the porch. I'll be back in a minute.
Don't, Julian said softly.
An expression of concern for me, or a warning that he sensed something might happen. Either way, doing nothing was not something I could do, and still believe I was a good person who deserved good people as friends. I walked up to the gate in Julian's enclosed front yard, reaching it at the same time Aiden came abreast of the cabin. He stopped and looked at me. Maybe it was the light last night, or the lack of it. Maybe it was the shock of being evicted and scrambling to move into the cabin. Today, in daylight, I couldn't pretend Aiden was human.
I wish I was stronger, I said. I wish I was braver. But the truth is, even though you helped me yesterday, I'm afraid of you. I'm afraid of what you can do.
You should be.
No attempt to tell me that what I felt was silly, because it wasn't silly.
Your species has some things in common with the shifters and how you touch and are touched by the world, Aiden said. My kind of terror, Indigeen. We're connected to the world in a way you never will be. We may tolerate your kind, even feel friendly towards some of you, but we'll never be your friend, Vicky. Not like the crows, or even the Sanguinati.
He took a few steps, then turned back, giving me a hint of a smile.
But if you need help lighting the wood stove, ask one of the crows to contact me, and I'll come by to get the fire started.
He and Twister walked away, heading toward the mill and the creek. I returned to the porch and took a healthy swallow of beer. Julian and I sat quietly, not feeling a need to fill the silence with unnecessary words, giving me time to think about my recent encounters with the Terra Indigene in general, and the elementals in particular. Friendly, but not a friend. I understood the distinction. I just didn't know what that distinction would mean for the humans in Sproing in the future. Chapter 65 Them Thaisday, Sumer 6th. Herschel stumbled out of the cabin and grabbed one of the posts that held up the porch roof. Feeling legless wasn't due to having too much to drink. It turned out fear had a way of keeping a man sufficiently sober. And fear could make a man feel weak. Well, screw that. Screw all of it. Should have known a putz like York Dane couldn't put together a solid deal. But Vaughn had said the property had potential. Even after they found out that Dane had given up the property, Vaughn didn't want to let go of a chance to have shares in a resort on one of the Finger Lakes, since the human places around those lakes were so limited. And he had considered how York's hanky ex-wife, the one who could be used until she was used up and then thrown away, could be worked to do the initial improvements before they came in to take over and build a real resort. But Dane had screwed up big time. Had glossed over the real reasons why his family hadn't done anything to develop what should be a prime piece of real estate. They were surrounded by the others here. Really surrounded by the others. And not just the crows and the furry guys. There was some seriously weird shit living in these woods. Like a tornado that targeted the two flatbed trucks and twisted them into an impenetrable tangle of burning metal that would take days to cut apart in order to reopen the access road. Like a fire that killed the loggers they had hired. No, Dane hadn't been upfront about a whole lot of things, including the fact that the land that was supposed to be his share of the investment didn't actually belong to him. Herschel struck out for the beach. Nice beach, but that didn't mean anything if all you had to offer was unfurnished cabins, and most of them didn't have indoor plumbing. Sure, they could furnish the renovated cabins. He'd suggested buying the furniture off of Vicky Devine. They could get it cheaper than buying new, since she wouldn't have a use for it. But Constance refused to consider the idea, said Vicky's tastes were too pedestrian. He wondered if Constance was starting to think that her choice of husband made her own taste a bit too pedestrian. After all, she and Vicky had married the same man. Herschel paused at the beach, then continued walking until he reached the dock that stretched out into the water. Didn't seem to be much good for a boat. Did people fish off the end of it? Did kids jump off the end of it, the way kids always wanted to do? He walked to the end of the dock. A starry night sky and dark water. Not even a single light on in the lodge across the lake. Piss on this place. As soon as that access road reopened, he was backing out of this loser deal and returning to Hubney, where he had other deals in the works. He grinned and put his hand in the opening in his boxers. Yeah, he'd piss on this place. He huffed out a pleased laugh as his urine hit the lake.
Monkey man.
No longer laughing, he finished up and tucked himself back into the boxers.
Monkey man. Spoiling our water.
Soiling our water.
He started to turn, started to ask who was out there, but something, someone, hit him from behind, sent him flying off the end of the dock. He hit the water hard and went under, and felt something pinch the triceps of his right arm, the calf of his left leg. He surfaced immediately, focusing on the dock, but whoever had pushed him was already gone. Something pinched his left forearm. He raised it above the water and stared at the wound. He'd been bitten. Something yanked on his leg, followed by several pinches. Not pinches. Bites. Something in the water was biting him. He took a breath, intending to yell for help. A hand rose out of the water, a hand with webbed fingers and curved, needle-like nails. The hand covered his face, the nails piercing his skin as he was shoved under the water. Thrashing, spinning as the things bit and bit and bit, he flailed, managed to break free a couple of times and reach the surface, but not long enough to call for help, barely long enough to suck in air before being pulled under again. Teeth sheared through one side of his neck. As he sank for the last time, he had the odd sensation of feeling his lower legs separate from the rest of him. Chapter 66 Grimshaw Firesday, Sumer 7th Grimshaw rinsed the shampoo from his hair, soaped up a cloth, and began washing himself. The Bristol CIU team had bunked at the jumble, making do with sleeping bags rolled out in the social room. Inike still had a full house, so Captain Hargreaves had been given Osgood's room, and the baby cop had slept on the sofa in the parlor. Today they would figure out whom to call in Bristol, or Crystalton, to disassemble the flatbed trucks and the construction equipment, and figure out where to haul it. Thankfully, that was Hargreaves's headache, not his. With Bristol taking the lead on the latest trouble in the jumble, he would stick to the village today. Walk the streets, check in with the businesses. When he got tired of that, he would take the desk and let Osgood patrol and soak up the gossip. He finished his shower and reached for a towel when he heard his bedroom door open. Crap. He'd locked that door. Always did. His service weapon wasn't in plain sight, but...
Grimshaw? Wayne!
Captain?
He wrapped a towel around his waist and walked out of the bathroom, beads of water running down his chest. Hargreaves stood in the middle of his room. Inike stood in the doorway. She seemed to appreciate the view he provided, but not the water he dripped on her hardwood floor. He quickly stepped onto the area rug. Not that that was much better, but at least Inike's presence, and the room key she held up for him to see, explained how Hargreaves had entered the room. He took in his captain's appearance, hastily dressed and unshaven, not showing pride in the uniform.
Get dressed, Hargreaves said. I'll wait for you in the car.
Ah, gods.
What happened?
The CIU team found part of a body at the jumble. On the beach.
A floater?
Hargreaves shook his head.
They think it's one of York Dane's business partners.
He walked out of the room, closing the door behind him. Grimshaw stared at the uniform he had hung on the hook, attached to the back of the bedroom door. There were things he hadn't put in any report. Things he wouldn't put on paper. But he should have told Hargreaves and the Bristol team about the creatures he and Julian had seen in the lake during the trail ride beach party. He couldn't have told them much, wasn't even sure what he'd seen. Except whatever lived in the lake, probably weren't the same creatures that had been whispering in the dark the night Constance Dane had been choked by freezing water in her own bathroom. 5 minutes later, he was dressed and heading downstairs. Inike met him at the front door and held out a large travel mug.
Coffee, she said. Sounds like you won't want to eat beforehand.
Thanks.
He took the coffee and walked out to Hargreaves's car. Seeing what was left of Herschel, Grimshaw felt glad he hadn't had breakfast and wished he hadn't drunk the coffee.
The bites aren't that much bigger than a human bite, but the teeth.
Samuel Kipp, Bristol CIU team leader, shook his head.
Not an animal. Some kind of fish? Teeth could have been sharp enough that the victim didn't feel much more than a pinch or a tug when the creatures bit off chunks of him.
Creatures?
Hargreaves asked.
More than one?
Kipp nodded.
At least a handful of different bite marks. And the marks on the face? Claws, maybe. I've got a man calling police stations located on the other Finger Lakes to see if they have any record of a similar attack.
He looked at Grimshaw.
Anyone around here who would be the village historian?
Grimshaw stared across the lake.
The residents of Silence Lodge probably could tell you exactly what did this, but I doubt the Sanguinati will be that forthcoming.
Why not?
Hargreaves asked.
Because they're closed-lipped about the elders who live on this land, and in the lake.
All the color leached out of Kip's brown face.
Gods. We went swimming last night. Dane and his missus were bitching about us using that general shower area off the kitchen, so we all went down to the lake to rinse off and cool off. We could have...
Not likely,
Grimshaw said.
I went swimming here, too. Julian Farrow and I saw something out there. Just a glimpse, but there was no indication we would be attacked.
A sudden thought made his heart give one hard bump.
Except, we were out here swimming when Vicky Devine was still in charge of the jumble.
He shook his head. Vicky was an important factor, but not the only factor.
There hasn't been a lot of downtime since I got here, but I did take a quick look at the reports that were filed at the station. An attack like this would have been reported. If nothing else, there would be a missing persons report or a copy of a DLU form. But people go fishing on the lake all the time. They swim at the public beach.
If this had happened before, Inike Xavier wouldn't have proposed bringing her guests here for beach parties. Activity behind him. Angry voices. Marmaduke Swin and Tony Amarella were squaring off with some of Bristol's CIU team, while Vaughn, Darren, and York Dane were yelling and creating a distraction. Grimshaw looked around.
Where are Reynolds and Hammerson?
They could be at the main house. The CIU team could be taking statements. Or they could be. A motor turned over. A sound coming from the other side of the dock.
Crap!
Grimshaw ran for the dock.
Reynolds! You can't put a motor in this lake! The police aren't doing anything, so we'll handle this.
Vaughn said, stepping in front of Grimshaw, getting in the way of him, stopping those fools before someone, something noticed them.
Going to make some chum.
Hammerson backed away from the dock, then headed for the middle of the lake, motor roaring. Reynolds stood braced against the windscreen, a shotgun aimed at the water, ready to shoot anything that surfaced in response to the sound of the motor. The boat roared out of sight, heading toward the northern end of the lake, then came roaring back before Hammerson began driving in a big circle that could be seen from Silence Lodge as well as the Jumble's beach. Circling. Circling, circling, circling. Even before Hammerson started shouting, started fighting to move the boat out of the circling water, Grimshaw knew the circles made by the boat's motor had changed into a whirlpool. Was it his imagination? Or was he seeing the shape of a steed emerging from the foaming water, racing and carrying the water with it?
carrying the boat with it? The boat was below the lip now. How soon before it flipped? Could Reynolds and Hammerson survive long enough to reach the surface? Or would they be carried down to the bottom of the lake? She rose without warning from the heart of the whirlpool, a giant female shape made of water. Her hands closed on the bottom of the boat and lifted it as her straight arms rose toward the sky. Her head, her shoulders, her torso. As her hips rose above the surface, she arched and dove back into the lake. Reynolds and Hammerson screamed as they tumbled out of the boat and hit the water moments before she slammed the boat on top of them, her dive taking everything down with her. The water circled, 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 but it was residual motion. The whirlpool, like the female, had vanished. The boat suddenly reappeared close to the dock, a projectile thrown by a giant hand. It struck the pickup truck still attached to the boat trailer, smashing through the cab and the windshield. While Yorick Dayne and his friends stood frozen in shock, Grimshaw ran to the end of the dock and searched the choppy water for any sign of the men.
"Do you see Reynolds?"
Swin shouted, pulling up the land end of the dock.
"Do you see him?"
The bottom of the lake had been churned up, turning the usually clear water cloudy. He couldn't see anything. Then Grimshaw spotted something orange moving toward the dock. Something under the surface, barely visible. A life vest? Reynolds had been wearing one. The wooden ladder attached to the dock didn't look new, but he went down anyway, testing each step until his ankles were in the water.
"Check the boathouse for a gaff or fishing net,"
he called to Hargreaves and Kip. Praying the ladder would hold his weight, he held on with one hand and squatted until his ass was almost touching the water. He stretched his other arm as far as he could, his heart pounding as his hand went under the water, as his fingers scrabbled to grab hold of what he could almost reach. Hands with webbed fingers and needle-like nails closed over the sides of the vest and lifted it a little higher, a little closer. Close enough for his fingers to grab the strap.
"Thanks," he breathed.
The hands disappeared. Feet pounded on the dock, and Kip flopped on his belly before reaching to help pull up whatever Grimshaw had found.
"Thanks," he'd said.
Nobody felt thankful when they hauled the life vest up to the dock and found Reynolds's severed arm and the shotgun secured to it. Grimshaw shot up the ladder and kept going until he stood several feet from the dock, and the water, and whatever lived there. He bent over and braced his hands on his knees. Hargreaves hurried to reach him.
"Wayne, are you all right?"
He wasn't a coward. He'd seen plenty of grisly things during his years on the force. But remembering the bite marks on Herschel's body and what body parts he'd been dangling too close to the water a minute ago made him queasy. He hadn't seen the face or the mouth, but he'd seen the curved nails at the ends of those webbed fingers. That vest didn't float up by chance. He spoke quietly enough that only Hargreaves would hear him.
"They're still out there, watching.
Guess we're not putting divers in that water," Hargreaves said.
"Not today."
If Hargreaves was smart, today would turn into never. Grimshaw straightened.
"I have to close the public beach." "Gods, yes."
Hargreaves pulled his car keys out of his trousers pocket.
"Take my car. I'll be here a while. I'll call Osgood to help me clear the beach and keep it closed."
He ran from the beach to the main house, then to the bridle path and game trail until he reached the road and the cars parked on the shoulder. A couple of the Crow Guard followed him to the road. He didn't know if they were just curious or keeping tabs on him. At least he hadn't heard any of those unnerving whispers. He still checked the front and back seats of the cruiser, then locked the doors as soon as he got in. He sagged in the seat for a minute. He gave himself that much time to wonder if the rest of the Finger Lakes held these kinds of secrets. Then he called Inike Xavier and asked her to fetch his spare pair of shoes and give them to Osgood. Finally, he called Osgood and gave the orders to meet him at Lake Silence's public beach. Starting the cruiser, he touched the metal under his shirt and offered up a brief prayer to Mikos before he put the vehicle in gear and drove to the beach. Chapter 67. Vicky. Fires Day, Sumer 7th. I didn't hear about the beach being closed until I walked over to come and get it to pick up lunch. Julian had put up a closed for inventory sign on Lettuce Reed's door, which I thought was an odd thing to do on a weekday. I worried that he was turning away potential customers and the needed income from book sales in order to keep me out of sight. But when I offered to pick up lunch, he gave me his order without any fuss, so I guessed that meant he wasn't sensing any danger in the village. The diner seemed more crowded than usual, and buzzing with people talking in low voices, as if they didn't want to be overheard but couldn't keep quiet. I gave my order to Helen. I wanted to ask what was going on, but she seemed stressed and had a booth of snooty women, including the two who had tried to cause trouble for Julian, snapping their fingers in a demand for attention. As it turned out, everyone thought I was the one who had the answers.
"Miss Vicky!"
A middle-aged man wearing overalls and a t-shirt approached, twisting a cap in his hands.
"Don't think we've met officially, but I've seen you around. I'm Fred from the bait and tackle shop on the south end of the lake."
"Oh, yes. Pleased to meet you."
He was the one who approached me, but he didn't seem all that pleased about it.
"Do you know why the chief closed the beach?"
Fred asked.
"Does it have anything to do with all the police being at the jumble?"
It took a moment to realize that chief meant Officer Grimshaw. It took another moment to realize that the buzz of voices had fallen to a few whispers from people in the booths farthest from the counter where I stood. "Officer Grimshaw closed the public beach?" I asked. Fred nodded.
"Wouldn't say why, just ordered everyone out of the water and told them to go home. Then he put an officer at the entrance to the parking area to stop anyone else from going to the beach. There's talk that something happened to one of the people staying at the jumble."
In school, I was not the kid who enjoyed presenting a report to the class. I wasn't the one who wanted to stand on the auditorium stage while people in the audience coughed politely or rustled their programs. But there I was, the center of attention, with my escape looking impossibly far away. Not to mention the door being blocked by Gershwin Jones, who was wearing a caftan of somber earth tones instead of his usual bright colors. A small village. I shopped here, had a passing acquaintance with most of the people who ran or worked in the businesses. I would have been one of the people who ran a business. "I don't know what's happening at the jumble," I said, looking at Fred. "My ex-husband repossessed the property and evicted me a few days ago. I don't have any information about what's going on there." Fred pursed his lips and finally nodded.
"Didn't know you'd been given the boot. But it makes sense that the trouble started when one of the Danes showed up."
"Really? Did the police know people in the village saw a correlation? Should I tell Grimshaw?"
"No.
It sounded like he was already up to his eyeballs in dealing with this. Besides, he knew exactly when York reclaimed the jumble. I'm sure Officer Grimshaw will get it sorted out very soon." I wasn't sure of any such thing, but Fred looked relieved to hear me say it. Suddenly, color filled his cheeks, and he wouldn't meet my eyes.
"You got someplace to stay while you sort things out?"
he asked. I didn't know the details of Fred's life, just that he ran the bait and tackle shop with Larry. But I translated the blush as an offer of a place to stay, which was sweet and a little confusing, since this was my first conversation with the man. "Thanks for asking. For now I'm staying with a friend." Not exactly the truth, But Ilya Sanguinati was insistent that I not tell anyone exactly where I was staying, and definitely not say that I was alone. It seemed silly. There were a limited number of places anyone could stay in Sproing, and if I wasn't staying at the boarding house, the Mill Creek cabins would be the next logical choice.
Staying with a friend, is that what they call it these days?
That from one of the snooty women sitting in the booth. Fred's hands tightened on his cap. Gershwin Jones, who struck me as a gentle, if flamboyant man, took a step closer to the booth. Helen thumped my lunch order on the counter, startling everyone. Then she leaned toward me and whispered,
"Best if you go before someone gets riled. I put the lunches on your tab."
Someone, meaning someone not human. Someone who might destroy the diner because a snooty customer took a verbal poke at me. I thanked Helen, took the food, and hurried back to let us read. When I entered the break room, Julian was on the phone.
"I'll talk to him if you think it will help. But I didn't see anything more than you did that day."
Julian hesitated.
"Stirred up. But that's been true for a couple of days. The current of fear is more intense. Not dangerous, but you need to tell them something."
"Okay.
Yeah."
He spotted me.
"Have to go."
I studied his pale face. What happened at the jumble? Why did Grimshaw close the public beach?
One of Dane's idiot friends took a motorboat out on the lake, and the lake's residents reacted as you might expect. Grimshaw closed the public beach as a precaution, just until everyone calms down.
I set our lunches on the counter next to the sink, no longer hungry. None of this would have happened if I hadn't tried to turn the jumble into a viable business.
"By all the gods, Vicky, get over yourself," Julian snapped.
He couldn't have hurt me more if he'd slapped my face. I thought Julian Farrow was my friend. I should have known better.
"He trained you to do that, didn't he?"
Julian said, softly, staring at me.
"He trained you to accept the blame whenever anything he did had consequences he didn't like. Vicky. Vicky. Look at yourself. You're backed into a corner, trembling."
Meltdown approaching. Had to stay strong long enough to get out of there.
"Vicky."
Julian held out a hand but didn't come any closer.
"Vicky, let me help you. Come over here and sit down."
Couldn't. Meltdown approaching. Hysteria. Weeping. Guilt for being so inadequate. Followed by agreeing with everything he said because that was the only way the yelling would stop. I was in a chair, crying, and Julian was on the phone again.
"I need you here. Now!"
Maybe Inike would come. I could talk to Inike. Maybe. Except she thought I was an interesting person, capable of running a business, and I didn't want her to find out the truth. I didn't want her to know I'd been pretending, that I really wasn't capable of doing anything. It wasn't Inike who walked into the break room and handed me a box of tissues to clean the snot off my face. It was Ilya Sanguinati. "Who was your physician in Hubney?" Ilya asked quietly. "I don't need medication." I'd always been afraid when he suggested that.
"When who suggested it?"
Ilya asked, making me think I'd said the words out loud.
"I didn't suggest it. Perhaps tea and whiskey? Isn't that a drink humans find calming?"
"I don't have the tea, but I have the whiskey," Julian said.
He leaned against the doorway, blocked the doorway.
"Victoria, who is this he you speak of?" Ilya asked.
He knew. We all knew. I had reacted to one man's bit of temper as if he were someone else.
"I was interested in your x-rays."
I blinked.
"Why?"
"They document broken bones." Ilya continued to look at me, quiet and benign. Why did he think I would have broken bones? Then I got it.
"He never hit me. He threatened to sometimes when he was very angry, but Yorick never hit me."
Words had been his fist of choice.
so not something I was going to tell my attorney, who might be sitting quietly, to avoid upsetting me, but was far from benign. How did I end up surrounded by scary men? Ilya, Aiden, Conan, Cougar, even Grimshaw, even Julian.
Would you take credit for someone else's achievement when you had nothing to do with that achievement? Ilya asked.
No.
Then don't take credit for someone else's mistakes. Yorick Dane and his friends were told they couldn't bring heavy equipment into the jumble. They were told motorboats were forbidden on the lake. They chose to ignore the rules. If you had been there, could you have stopped them?
Would they have listened?
No, I said. Since they wouldn't have listened to you, I strongly suggest that you not accept guilt for actions you didn't commit and could not have stopped.
Ilya stood up.
I still want the name of your former doctor. You can drop it off at my office on your way home.
Ilya and Julian left the break room. Julian returned a minute later and sat down.
I'm sorry, I said.
Julian rubbed a hand over his mouth. Then he sighed. During the months when you were restoring the jumble and teaching yourself how to run a business, how to run a resort, I thought you were a little nervous sometimes, especially around men. I figured you were emotionally burned by your divorce, and definitely gun-shy about dating. But you were getting on with your life. I never imagined you experienced panic attacks this severe. I felt sick with shame. It doesn't take much, does it? Just the wrong phrase, or the wrong smell, or seeing the wrong person and it all comes back. The pain, the fear. Julian tried to smile. I can't watch the cop and crime shows you enjoy so much. I never know when the wrong combination of things will be in the story, and then I'm back in that alley, trying to get away from the men who want to kill me, not sure if I can get up and find help before I bleed out. I triggered this in you today, and I'm the one who's sorry. The last thing I want to do is sound like your ex.
You don't! I'm not even sure what I heard.
I understand that. Sproing was such a marginal place, there hadn't been any police officers working out of the station here until Grimshaw showed up, temporarily reassigned. Had Sproing's lack of crime been a relief to Julian, that the village could get along with calling the police in Bristol whenever there was trouble? What about now? Had he closed his store today because he had needed to lock out all the trouble and turmoil?
You've had some episodes recently, haven't you? With all the police here investigating, and the questions about the tie clippers.
I haven't had any bad episodes since I bought the bookstore, not even when I had some unusual customers. But since I've been helping the police with these inquiries, I've had a few bad moments.
Does Grimshaw know?
Julian shook his head. And you're not going to tell him.
You're his friend. Don't you think he should know what this is doing to you?
Vicky. If he knew, he wouldn't ask for my help. And I have a feeling, a very strong feeling, that some lives will depend on my helping him.
Chapter 68. Grimshaw. Firesday, Sumer 7th. Grimshaw knocked on the back door of Lettuce Reed. When no one answered, he knocked again, louder. As he debated the wisdom of breaking down the door, he saw Vicky's face on the other side of the glass and heard locks turning.
Officer Grimshaw?
He scanned her face, puffy from a crying jag, but no visible bruises. Gods, he wasn't answering a domestic call. At least he hoped not. Abusive relationships didn't always include sex.
I'd like to come in.
He knew how easily he could use his size and the uniform to intimidate someone, so he made an effort not to lean forward. As Julian had said, he needed to be the good cop.
Sure, Vicky said, stepping back to let him in. I'm helping Julian inventory stock, and we're having a late lunch. Would you like something to eat? We have plenty.
Thanks. I could use some food.
nerves. Awfully close to the behavior he'd seen when Detective Swin had tried to bring her in for questioning in the death of Franklin Cartwright. He followed Vicky into the break room. Julian's version of the murder game wasn't in sight, which was good. Julian, however, looked pale and rough, and having seen that particular kind of shadow in the eyes of men who had served in the wild country for a little too long, he understood some things about Julian, and cursed his friend for hiding the difficulties so well. He'd known better than to throw Osgood, who had seen Tara Indigene kill other members of Swin's team, back into the jumble. But he'd pulled Julian back into working with the police because he'd needed backup he could trust, and he'd needed Julian's knowledge of the people living here, as well as the man's investigative skills. He'd ignored Julian's half-hearted attempts to back away from this tangle of deaths. He'd thought the reluctance was because of the way Julian had left the force. He hadn't realized that by asking for help, he'd trapped his friend between feeling compelled to help and the need for self-preservation.
"Anything I should know?"
he asked.
"Rough day," Julian replied, his tone warning Grimshaw to drop the subject.
Vicky found another plate and set out the food. The amount wasn't excessive, but Grimshaw figured neither she nor Julian had much of an appetite. He, on the other hand, was ravenous, and felt grateful he didn't have to venture into a public place to find something to eat.
"I'm going to be making a public announcement later this afternoon," he said. "Have to explain about closing the beach, and other things." "You hate making public announcements," Julian said, almost smiling. "Can't Captain Hargreaves handle that? Isn't the Bristol station taking the lead?"
"He'll be there," Grimshaw replied sourly.
"And Bristol is taking the lead. But I'm still stuck with the announcement. Anyway, we're going to close off this block of Main Street to vehicular traffic a half an hour before the announcement, which will be done outside the police station. You do recall that Main Street is the only way in or out of this village."
"Yep."
That was the reason he was closing it down. There was the odd chance of a stranger driving through, either on purpose or by accident, and hitting one of the villagers gathered in the street for an announcement he figured wouldn't take more than 5 minutes.
"I might cause the first traffic jam in Sproing's history."
"How many vehicles constitutes a traffic jam?" Vicky asked.
1% of the population,"
he replied promptly. She blinked.
"But that would be 3 vehicles.
"Yep."
Julian took a bite of a sandwich and chewed slowly.
"I don't remember that rule of thumb. That's because I made it up."
A stupid conversation, but Grimshaw saw the change in Julian, saw the moment his friend stepped back from some personal abyss.
"Is this the first time you caused a traffic jam?" Vicky asked, as if his causing trouble this afternoon was a given.
He wasn't sure if that assumption was an insult, but she, too, was looking calmer, so he'd run with it.
"No, I've done it a few times. The most memorable was a couple of years ago. I came across a young deer that had been hit by, well, probably a truck. It was across one lane of a 2-lane road in the wild country, and the carcass was surrounded by crows.
Maybe not the best story to tell while they were eating. Then again, Vicky didn't seem to notice.
Now, I couldn't tell if they were crows or crow guard, but I figured the latter, since several of them ran toward my cruiser, with their wings raised, as if trying to intimidate me. I pulled the cruiser across both lanes, put on the lights, and got out."
"How many crows?"
Julian asked.
"A lot. They covered both lanes. I took some heavy gloves out of the trunk and approached the carcass, thinking to pull it over to the shoulder. Nothing doing. So I walked up ahead, getting my ankles pecked for my efforts, and I held up traffic for an hour before the crows had eaten their fill and flown up into the nearby trees. Then I pulled the carcass over to the shoulder, got back in my cruiser, and I and the dozen cars who waited drove away.
I wonder if the Crow Guard would do things differently now, Vicky said.
How so?
Well, ever since Aggie moved into the cabin, she's been coming over to watch the cop and crime shows with me, so I think she would recognize police cars and understand police officers are there to help. So maybe now you could explain why it would be safer to move the carcass to the side of the road where the Crow Guard could feed without being hurt by passing cars. Grimshaw finished his share of the lunch.
Something to consider.
At any rate, I wanted to give you a heads up so you could get out before you're blocked in. Not that I expect the announcement to take up much time.
Appreciate the heads up, Jillian said.
He pushed away from the table.
Thanks for the meal.
Jillian walked him to the back door.
What time are you making the announcement? 5 o'clock.
Grimshaw studied his friend. The shadows in Julian's eyes hadn't disappeared.
Not completely. You should have told me.
Jillian didn't pretend not to know what he was talking about.
I had my own reasons for not telling you. Are they still valid?
Yes, Wayne.
They are. It's part of the job,
Captain Hargreaves said. Standing in the police station, watching with his captain as a crowd gathered on the street, Grimshaw grunted.
I'm Highway Patrol. This isn't part of my job description.
Now it is. Suck it up and do the job.
Hargreaves sounded testy. Grimshaw could understand that. If he'd been the one dealing with York Dane and his pals today, he'd be testy too. Checking the clock on the wall, he adjusted his belt and walked outside, glad of Hargreaves's support.
Many of you already know there have been several fatal incidents at the jumble. None of these incidents were human against human. The police are still investigating in order to understand what provoked the attacks.
Ask the Dane family,
a man in overalls shouted. Grimshaw ignored him.
The latest incident involved two men who took a motorboat out on the lake, despite being told about the no motor rule.
Lots of head shaking and muttering in the crowd.
The response to the motorboat was of sufficient force that I decided to close the public beach for a day or two. While I don't believe anyone in Sproing is in danger of an unprovoked attack, I do believe allowing everyone to calm down is essential for public welfare. I'm in charge of this police station. Until that changes, I'm not taking chances with your lives.
Murmurs of approval.
When are you chucking Dane and his hoity-toity friends out of the jumble so Miss Vicky can go back home and get all this straightened out?
Helen from Come and Get It asked. He heard a couple of sharp female voices protesting Helen's term for influential businessmen from Hubney, but mostly he heard rumblings of agreement. They wanted York Dane out of the jumble, out of Sproing, and far away from Lake Silence.
That's not my jurisdiction.
Before someone said the wrong thing and turned a crowd into a mob, Grimshaw held up a hand.
However, Miss Devine has an excellent attorney who was scrutinizing every document Mr. Dane presented. Sanguinati.
Yeah, he'll sort things out.
He didn't recognize the voices, but he found the sentiment unsettling. When it came to choosing between businessmen like York Dane and the Sanguinati, the majority of people in Sproing seemed to be voting for the vampires. Was that a change in allegiance? Or had enough of the people here always been aware of who controlled their village from the shadows? And had they just pretended to be clueless?
The beach will remain closed tomorrow,
he said.
Barring any unforeseen circumstances, you should be able to resume water activities the day after.
Of course, Ames' funeral home was currently filled to capacity with unforeseen circumstances. The crowd dispersed. Grimshaw breathed a sigh of relief. But when the people scattered to return to their jobs or head home, he saw another crowd had formed in front of the bookstore. Sproingers filled the sidewalk in front of Lettuce Reed, climbing on each other to see into the windows or cling to the screen door. Had Jillian put out a treat this morning? Or were they focused on the store for some other reason?
What's going on over there?
Hargreaves asked.
Don't know.
Before he could decide if it would be prudent to investigate, Gershwin Jones approached him. The big man studied the Sproingers, then looked at him.
I have a feeling they're going to come